I don't have negotiating advice. I'm terrible at it. I fear it. I overthink it. And I am going to see how far Rich Voss gets me. Rich Voss?
Oh, dear.
Chris Voss. There's a comedian called Rich Voss.
Do that again. That was really good until you messed it up by saying the wrong name. I'll sort it out in the edit.
I can't even remember what I said. Yeah, I can't negotiate. I hate it. I fear it. I'm bad at it. And I'm going to rely on Chris Voss.
So the book we're talking about is called Never Split the Difference, and it's by Chris Voss. It came out in 2016, and Chris Voss was an FBI negotiator. The book is about applying the techniques he learned as an FBI negotiator into everyday life. It's a self-help book in the sense that you would read this to learn how to become a better negotiator. It includes a lot of advice that's rooted in psychology. In some ways, it's a practical book, and in other ways, it has this 48 Laws of Power style insanity to it.
I was going to say, if 48 Laws is for the boardroom, this is for the used car salesman.
This is for the used car salesman, 100%.
Most people are going to use this to like sell business-to-business SaaS products or a used car or negotiate a salary at a new job or something, where you're dealing with nice people that you're not trying to manipulate necessarily. Whereas he's done this at the very high stakes version, where like if you lose the sale as an FBI negotiator, someone gets shot in the head. And also you have no empathy, no real empathy for these people that are like taking hostages, trying to manipulate a bank robber into not shooting the guard in the head.
That's okay.
You're not like, I'm being manipulative here. You're like, I hope this guy fucking believes me.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of the anecdotes in this book are about hostage negotiations. And I did kind of wonder if it would just have been better as a memoir. And like, I don't know, I went back and forth on that, as some of the anecdotes are a little bit samey. It's always like, here's how I used my principles that I just described to free all the hostages.
I think it's great. This format I really enjoy. It's this 48 Laws is another one, but 48 Laws is a slog because it's 48 hours.
Bing, just a quick fact check on this. The audiobook version of 48 Laws of Power is actually 23 hours long.
The format of like point and then story to tell that point. When I first read that, I was like, how the fuck is anything that like Cleopatra did going to be relevant to my life? And then you sort of, after a while, you're like, oh, they're people too. They're not totally different people. Like, they're still people.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing in both books. You get this principle and you start thinking, oh, this is maybe how I would apply this in my life. And then you get the example, and that will be from, like, ancient Greek warfare.
If you're trying to sell a used car or a new car, if you don't buy the car, that's it. And so you're like, if you're a hostage negotiator, like failing, if you shoot the person, you're getting shot in the head by a sniper. It's a suicide negotiation a lot of the time. That person's sort of looking for any reason not to do the thing, I feel like. It's not like you have this like disinterested customer who's like, oh, maybe I won't rob the bank.
I've been questioning if the title of this book even makes sense, because the idea of splitting the difference is just like not relevant to any of the hostage stuff. There's one bit where he's even like, you can't split the difference when negotiating with someone who's taken hostages. And it's like, yeah, you can't. So why have you called the book this?
All right, how about you kill half the hostages and we call it quits?
Well, that's what I mean. It's just like not a thing.
The reason I read this book was because I was about to do a salary negotiation. And I can explain to you how that went, which is I had a verbal offer for a job at a certain salary. And I was like, I need more money than that, but I'm going to wait until I have it in writing. And then we've got some numbers we can be pushing backwards and forwards. So I was reading this book in preparation. I had like 2 weeks between the verbal and the written. It was a whole fucking faff. So I was like, I need to become an expert negotiator. I've never negotiated a job before. My previous times getting a job, I remember distinctly, I got a job offer for a company in London. I knew what their range was. So I asked for a number. And I was like, how about this? And they were like, yep. And I was like, fuck. It was so much more money than I'd ever earned in my life that I was like, this is crazy high. It was like nearly double what I'd previously been on. So I was just like, that's such a big number. And then they were like, yep, no problem. And I was like, oh, fuck. And then I remembered that. And then the next time I got a job, I had been fired and I had a baby on the way. So I was just like, I'll work anywhere that pays me money. So the next job, I took a pay cut, but didn't negotiate as well. I was just like glad to be employed. And so this time I was like, all right, I'm going to do it properly. I'm not fired. I've been in the industry and I understand my value. I know what I can go for here. They give me the written version of the offer and I push back and I'm like, that's all very well. But I was thinking, and I tried to use some of the Voss style techniques of like tactical empathy. How am I supposed to do that? Or whatever. Yeah. I pushed back and they were like, so yeah, the time for negotiation is actually over. You should have raised that like 2 weeks ago. This is a final offer, but I'll take it to the team. And I was like, oh, fuck, I fucked this up completely. And then they came back and they were like, the team says no. And then the next day they went, now the job doesn't exist anymore. I was like, this is a total disaster. This has gone as badly as it could possibly go. And I've been reading this book for like a week trying to become an expert.
So the early conclusion is that none of this stuff works.
The only thing that I know works, because I've done it in a different context, there is a technique in here where he talks about giving a very specific number.
Oh, that, yeah. That's good, that bit.
Because that seems calculated.
I mean, this kind of trick, when he mentioned it, I was like, oh shit, this is like, people are doing this to me.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a look at some of the specific techniques Chris has included in the book. The first one of these is called mirroring, and this involves repeating the last three words back to the person when they're speaking to you. This is combined with another technique called the downward inflecting DJ voice, or the late night DJ voice.
Late night DJ voice? Wait, no, that I went up. Late night DJ voice.
Late night DJ voice?
You gotta go down.
You gotta go down.
You gotta go down. So you go late night DJ voice.
I have been practicing this, believe it or not, but it doesn't seem to be getting better. The third tip from kind of early on in the book is to start with I'm sorry.
Yeah, the apology audit or something, right?
I think the I'm sorry is pretty good. Like, so I used to work for a company that had a customer services department, and there was a policy in place to never apologize or admit faults. I mean, that just would piss people right off.
Oh, yeah.
There were some circumstances where we were at fault and the customer would definitely have appreciated it if we'd admitted it. And there were other situations where even if you know you're not at fault, just say, I'm sorry, you know, that's free. You don't have to be sorry. You don't have to mean it, but just say, I'm sorry. That starts the negotiation in a good place. He combines these different pieces of advice into an example where ladies at work and the boss comes in asking for two copies of the paperwork to be photocopied. And the worker replies using the late night DJ voice, I'm sorry, two copies?
Yeah. She's like, this guy's just making me do this for no reason. Like, this was back in the day.
This was in the day of photocopiers.
Yeah. We existed during that time. I remember that being a big part of what teachers did at school.
This book was from 2016.
True, but I think the examples were probably from like the mid-70s.
Yeah, no, I did wonder, like, I think with anything, I mean, the problem with these books, with the genre really, is that so much in them is wrong that they don't age well.
People are so different, especially like a book written about Americans in the 90s, which is probably where the bulk of this comes from.
You're trying to give specific advice, but in this like book that's designed to be for like a very wide audience.
Anyone who joined the workforce post-pandemic has a very different life. And we only were like in the workforce pre-pandemic for a decade at most. The idea of going to the office every day just isn't on the radar for certain people. So imagine like your whole life is just, if you grew up remote for everything, and like the last time you interacted with people face to face was in school, and half of that was remote because of a pandemic, your ability to have any kind of conflict is very low.
But a lot of these techniques were developed through hostage negotiations, and that was the original remote working. I mean, a lot of this stuff was done over the phone. And the downward inflecting DJ voice, that works on Zoom.
It does. I think that voice does make you feel like you're being a baby. If someone's like, how am I supposed to do that? And you're like, wait, am I being unreasonable?
Yeah, no, I was kind of being disingenuous. I think this is some of the worst advice in the book. Like, I don't think that the downward inflecting DJ voice offers any value. I do think there's some stuff in this book that's all right. I just think that that is not helpful to people.
That's one thing that I had kind of forgotten about, is the downward inflecting DJ voice. Because I knew whilst listening to that, that I'm like, I'm just not going to be doing that. but doesn't mean it doesn't work.
Yeah, I think it might work in a hostage negotiation. I'm just not sure if it would work for you and me.
Yeah, I mean, this is set up, I guess, for, yeah, people you don't know.
Let's carry on with the theory and take a look at some of the other advice. There's quite a lot here, and it would be good to go through, get your thoughts on the effectiveness of some of this stuff. He's got quite a lot about the importance of listening and also calling people by their first name. It's got this very Dale Carnegie flavor to it.
That's basically the main thing I remember from How to Win Friends, is just like Dale Carnegie says something like, the most sweet sound in the English language is someone's own name, and you should use their name over and over again. I think, does he call that out in this as like people are very much like primed to listen for that now?
Early on, he says to do it, and then later on, he's like, don't do it too much.
Yeah.
I think the issue is that it's become quite well known as a salesman's technique. So it's like, if you do it too much, then it's going to sound like you're doing something you've learned from a self-help book.
For sure.
This is me practicing another technique that Chris advocates, which is the long silence.
The long silence is incredibly effective. I will fill silences. There's definitely people I've worked with who absolutely cannot tolerate a silence of any kind, and they will just start talking. It's such a powerful technique. I'm the guy who fills the silence most of the time. So I'm like, I'm going to try and sit in this whilst it's killing me inside that no one is speaking.
So one of Chris's tactics is just to admit that he's an asshole. Like, he would just say, I'm an asshole. And that would be how he would diffuse a situation.
That is definitely a technique that works.
Do you have to like be an asshole in the first instance though, before that works?
No, I think you over apologize. It's like you're priming somebody for something way worse to happen. You're like, I'm a real dick because I'm about to do this unreasonable ask. And then they're primed for like, is this guy going to ask for my firstborn child? And then you go, could I please go in front of you in the line or something?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a better explanation of how the technique could be practically used. I think his I'm an arsehole thing made me laugh, firstly, because I couldn't see a direct application of it, but also because it comes in the book near to this anecdote that he gives about when he went to Canada and he didn't have the correct paperwork or permission from the FBI. So he has to phone up the head of the FBI and apologize. And I was kind of expecting him to use the technique he'd just described and be like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm an arsehole.
I remember that phone call. What technique does he use to chill the guy out? Or you're saying he just doesn't do it?
He has this religious thing. He's like, sorry, Father, I've been a bad boy.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, Father, for I've sinned. Or if he comes in being like comically over apologetic, which makes the guy seem... It's a really good technique of just like making someone's emotions seem ridiculous because you're kind of front running them a little bit and being like, I have done something wrong. But he's also adding some theatrics to it where the guy's like, yeah, you have. He's like playing into this persona that Chris has created for him as an unreasonable person. It's kind of brilliant psychology.
So we like that one.
I like it. I don't know if that's my move. Again, most of my interactions with people are going to be via email.
I thought you were going to say most of my interactions, I do start with I'm an arsehole.
I'm trying to think if I've ever done... that one. I know I've definitely been on the receiving end of that from people where they're like, okay, so don't hate me.
Don't hate me. That's good. That's like a more like English version. I think if it said that, I'd have been like, yeah, okay. I can see the value of saying, don't hate me.
Don't be mad.
Don't be mad.
But I did a thing. And you're like, immediately I'm like, what the fuck has happened? And then it's like, I ordered a new picture frame. And you're like, oh, okay, well, that's not. And that is the technique happening to me.
The power of no. This is a section of the book that personally I was a little skeptical of. So he firstly talks about what is called a yes ladder. And this is like a classic salesman technique. The idea here is that you get the person agreeing with you. And if you can get them to say yes three times, then they're more likely to say yes to whatever you ask them next.
They're like, yes, 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 yes.
But what we learned from Chris is that this might not work. This is another one where part of the issue is that people know what a yes ladder is and they're not falling for it anymore. Because of that, he has his own reverse yes ladder, which he calls the power of no. The idea here is to specifically elicit a no answer. He kind of further adds to this by saying that the problem with yes is that if someone says yes to you, they might be lying. Whereas if someone says no, they might not be lying.
That is true.
There were points in this book where I wasn't sure if what he was then saying illustrated the point or if it was just not meant to and was just like a separate thing. Because he then gives this example of where he's actually like applying for his job as a hostage negotiator. The interview questions are like, do you have experience relevant for this job? And he's like, no. Have you ever worked in this industry? No. And he's answering no to everything. So I'm like, great. He's going to just get the job through, you know, the power of no, this reverse yes ladder. And then at the end, she's like, you absolutely didn't get the job. And he's like, come on. Well, like, why not?
She was like, why would I hire you? And then she goes, go and work at a suicide hotline.
She does. He has to go and work a suicide hotline for 5 months.
I think the no thing is very interesting. Like, I've read... what was the sales book I read recently? Spin Selling, it's called. I actually think I only got about halfway through it before I pivoted to Chris Voss because I had an upcoming negotiation. In the same way that Chris Voss is like, this is the book on negotiation. Everyone should start here if they want to read about negotiation. Spin Selling is the like, here's modern sales. The beginning of the book is just laying out the getting to yes and the yes ladder and like why that does work for like short, if you're doing a short interaction, like you need someone to buy a ticket to your show and you're shouting at them on the street, or you need to make a short-term interaction for low stakes and low money happen now versus modern high stakes sales where you might be talking to someone for many, many months and you're trying to get them to subscribe to your $30,000 a year software package. And it's like a long-term meaningful relationship that you need to continually manage. That is not the same. And you're not doing this kind of like get them to yes thing. It's much more about like figuring out what their concerns are. I didn't get as far into the book to figure out how to actually make these sales, but I did get the whole spiel of like why traditional sales techniques don't work. And this guy was going to people and being like, analyzing the all of the salespeople and be like, okay, this is what your top salespeople are doing and versus your bottom salespeople. And like the head of sales will be like, yeah, they're asking open-ended questions that have positive answers and they're doing this, this, and this. He's like, no, that's not what's actually happening. He's like, well, they're closing a lot, you know, always be closing. The top salespeople are always trying to pick get people to the close. And it's like, no, not actually. Like there was this one guy who was like the best used car salesman by a huge margin. He's like America's best used car salesman. And his technique was all around, this person will buy another car from me in 3 years if this goes well. So he wouldn't hard sell them. And he would be thinking about it from a, this is a relationship I need to manage over time. And obviously his first few years weren't great, but then as you build up this like reputation for being not a hard seller, someone who's easy to deal with, someone who will be flexible with you and makes these people leave going, oh, that was a good transaction. They'll buy a car off you every 3 years and you'll have a 30-year career where you're making 10 sales off each person. That's what made him the best salesman. So it's really interesting.
Let's carry on with the analysis. I want to talk a bit about fairness, which is the next thing Chris brings up in the book. And the points he made here seem fairly reasonable about being fair and being an honorable negotiator. But for me, this bit was let down a bit by the fact that it's accompanied by an anecdote involving Robin Williams and his role playing the genie in the film Aladdin. So he does this for a discounted rate, almost as a favour to Disney. And when the film does really well, Disney gift him a Picasso painting because he's now upset that he wasn't paid very generously for his work. So Chris uses this to make a point about fairness. But I looked this up and it turned out that the reason Robin Williams was upset was that he had a contract in place with Disney that limited how much the genie could be used when marketing the film. So Disney just like broke this agreement, and that's why they had to get him back on side by buying him this Picasso painting. It doesn't actually illustrate the point the way it's presented in the book. It's very misleading.
That is, I mean, also, what kind of a fucking payment is a Picasso painting unless you're already insane or very wealthy?
Oh, no, he got paid money as well. The Picasso painting was like a gift.
It's valuable as well, right? Like Picasso would, but it's probably worth millions.
Yeah, I think the painting was worth more than he was originally paid. So it was like a very like extravagant gift, obviously.
It's probably some way that you can like, Disney were like, well, we should write off a bunch of tax. like we got that art and we got to write off all the taxes as a charitable donation or something.
There's a lot of like examples in this book, which are from like his own experience. So it's not really possible to say how accurate his interpretation is, but the ones that are like more universal, I looked them up and they were mostly distortions of the truth.
He's emotionally manipulating you into agreeing with him.
He's just lying, I think.
This is a whole book about how he lies to people to get his own way. So, you know,
you've got to expect that some of the anecdotes are going to be a little bit...
It's the rhetorical equivalent of the late night DJ voice.
So going back to the problem with yes, he has some advice specifically for telemarketers. He says that rather than saying... Let me make sure I get this the right way around. He says, rather than saying, is now a good time to talk, you should say... No, wait, rather than saying, is now a bad... I can't even remember which one of these. Let me figure it out.
He says, is now a bad time to talk? And because if now's a good time to talk, you can say no.
And that's good, because he wants you to say no. But I thought about this, and I personally think that neither is particularly different from the other, and also that it would be better to do neither. And when I get unsolicited phone calls, the ones that kind of are hardest to get out of are the ones where they just start talking.
I guess it's kind of like, you know, Darren Brown's mental tricks that he would play on people where there's like an automated loop your brain goes into. I wonder if like the saying no is just like that shortcutting that loop. Because if you say like, is now a bad time to talk? What it's really asking you is what else is going on in your life that means that you're busy? And so your brain has to come up with something. Even if you don't say that to the person, your brain has to engage. Whereas if you go, is now a good time to talk? You're already like in a negative mindset. It's very like, no, click. So what he's saying is like, the no is what's on the tip of the person's tongue. So I want to elicit that in a way that means they've now just agreed to talk to me. So I think that might be the like clever psychology.
There's another example he gives here, and we'll get your thoughts on this, because he gives this example of some sort of right-wing fundraising campaign. And the question is like, do you hate Obama? Which the recipient is expected to answer yes. And the script was then changed to a format with a no answer. The question was now, will you stand for Obama's re-election? And apparently this version of the script did a lot better. Chris Voss says that this is because it's now eliciting a no answer. Although personally, when I read this, I thought, one, this wasn't properly tested. And two, like, it's just a different question.
You're pushing the apathetic response into one of the two categories. The first one is like, do you hate Obama? And you're kind of like, maybe you're a Republican, you didn't like his policies, but you don't hate him. Or you're just like, you're kind of a meh response. The meh response is not what they're trying to elicit there. So if you're just like, I don't hate Obama. But if they go, are you going to be standing in defense of Obama? If you're the meh person, then you're going to be like, well, no. They've taken like the category of yes and the category of no, and they've added the category of I don't really give a shit and moved that one way or the other. So I think you're right. It's like it's a different question, and they're using that to take the apathetic response in the direction that they want, which will capture more people theoretically. That would be my theory there.
So we're skeptical.
I understand you can't really apply any of these techniques wholesale.
He does have this bit where he tries to break down three different types of negotiator.
Okay.
It is definitely a bit like a horoscope by the time you get to this. I think it's as close to pseudoscience as we get in the book. But he does say that there is an analyst who's methodical and systematically working towards the best result. And that's different to an accommodator, which is just your Jack the Lad car salesman, whatever. And the assertive type. And Chris assures us that he is the assertive type who believes that time is money and negotiation is about winning.
Me and Chris, more like that. Late night radio DJs.
What I kind of took from this is there's some broad advice, which is like, don't be too nice, don't be too mean, and don't act like a robot. But beyond that, I think it would almost be like a mistake to try and get too literal with some of this stuff and be like, so is this person more of an analyst or an accommodator? Like,
I think you can definitely make mistakes if you're trying to like okay, which type am I dealing with? And then you just like over-index on like half a sentence they say, and then be like, right, I'm dealing with this type, and just throw everything down that hallway.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely something around the archetype. There are different archetypes of people. It's situational as well. I guess you're trying to figure out, and this is really hard to do in my experience, and that might be because I'm a bastard energy red man, but figuring out what does this person want? Because this happens to me quite a lot where people are like, come to you with a problem that's their fucking problem. And they're like, we need you guys to do this thing and that thing because of my reasons. And I don't give a shit about your reasons. So you need to come to me and say like, here's why helping me with my problem will be good for you. And a lot of people don't understand that. They come in and they're like, this is just good for the business generally. And you're like, yeah, but I don't fucking give a shit because I have my own problems. And I don't say, obviously don't say that, but I'm thinking like, help me understand why this is good for both of us. Either here's why this will be good for you, or here's what I'll do for you if you help me. People don't give a shit about your problems, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And so you have to like think about what they want.
He has some email trick here. So he was down with the technology, it turns out, even though it was only 2016. And he says that the one trick guaranteed to get a response to your email is to use the phrase, have you given up on this project?
Yeah, that's a very, very spicy one.
It's spicy. I mean, I kind of, at first, I was like, this is so, it's like, what is the prior interaction? Like, who is this? Who are these people? Who's sending this? Who's receiving this? I mean, he loves this. Like, he comes back to this. Now, Chris Voss has like a consultancy service where you can pay him and he will send this email on your behalf.
So, you know what's interesting? A guy who I manage at work has been on a Chris Voss course.
Really?
Yeah, because I was telling him, I was like, I'm reading Never Split the Difference. He was like, I did the course with Chris Voss.
Negotiate like a hostage.
Yeah. It's interesting because the guy who's like not someone you would think is like of from the school of Chris Voss at all.
I'm sorry. I'm sensing you've given up on this project.
It's very harsh and they're going to hate you, but they will immediately do whatever it is you need because they don't want to be like accused of giving up on a project.
I have like a version of this that I do use, but it's like, it's not quite as cutting. I have like a kind of stock email I go to, which is to just email someone saying, do you have an update on the below? If I was in this situation, I would send that email every 2 days until I got a response. And because it's less cutting, you can actually just fire it off again and again and not feel too bad.
I've been hit with that one before.
You don't actually need to be like a massive dick in this situation. You just need to get your email chain back to the top of someone's inbox to remind them to deal with it.
It's not that someone's ignoring you. It's that you've literally slipped out of their...
Forgot.
Yeah, right.
We've got an interesting bit here.
Okay.
Which is a section of the book dedicated to the concept of using the phrase, that's right.
Or getting someone to say that, right? Yeah. You're trying to elicit a that's right.
That's right. And by this point in the book, we have already debunked the yes ladder. We've said yes ladder doesn't work. But then we've got this kind of substitute, which when you think about it, is like basically the same thing in terms of just like eliciting compliance from like the other person. This was the bit where kind of thinking about this and being like, yeah, okay, I kind of get this conceptually. And then he gives this big anecdote about Colonel Gaddafi and the hostages. And it's like, I'm not totally convinced that the use of the phrase, that's right, was kind of in the grand scheme of like this situation was really kind of much of like a defining factor.
I think it's less about the specific phrase.
Well, it's just about getting the person to agree with you. And obviously that's going to be part of like a successful negotiation.
Yeah. It's like getting the person to think this guy gets it. And then they're now open to more suggestions, especially if you have got a gun to someone's head and you're working for Colonel Gaddafi or whatever, or against him, as I think it was, I can't remember. You're definitely going to be like, this FBI guy doesn't get the situation I'm in where I'm pointing this gun at this lady. And so that's a lot of business conversations, I guess, is people being like, this fucking idiot doesn't know what, just doesn't get it. I've been in a lot of meetings where I'm like, these people don't get it. And then someone will say something and I'm like, that guy gets it.
And you're like, that's right.
That's right. And then you go, this guy has just said something that I feel like no one else except me gets. So now I'm listening to everything they say.
But would the advice not be to say something insightful and relevant to the context of the meeting?
But it's also, it's not as generic of advice as it sounds initially. It's not like he's saying, say that's right. He's saying, get them to say that's right. And that now means you have to come up with something smart to say.
Yeah, I guess what my point is, maybe the advice should have been, come up with something smart to say.
Get them to be like, that is right. Yeah.
That is right.
You get me. We should be best friends after this kidnapping is over.
Never compromise. Splitting the difference is wearing one brown shoe and one black shoe.
I liked that metaphor because splitting the difference just seems like such a default. You know, you reached an impasse with somebody, but splitting the difference only works on like a continuous scale, not on a discrete scale. There's that famous, I think it's a Bible story about the child, and they're trying to figure out whose child it is. And they're like, well, why don't I just cut this child in half and you can have half each?
Oh, yeah, yeah, that is the Bible. Yeah, that's probably like Samson or something.
Something like that.
Bing, it's Solomon. It's like a compromise would be you wear the brown shoes one day and the black shoes the next day. The issue is like how you're applying that in a way that's like purposefully stupid.
Yeah, well, I think purposefully stupid to illustrate. He's basically saying you'd never do that because that's obviously stupid. But there are other compromises that are stupid that maybe are less obvious. Does he talk about a more concrete example?
Of not compromising.
Find the underlying interest. That's what he talks about. He's like, okay, is there something that they can give you that costs them nothing that's outsized value to you? Instead of compromising on the thing that you both share value over, shift the conversation.
His example is always like a magazine cover. And he said, well, if they'll put me on the cover of a magazine, I'll do it for free.
Yeah. And it's the thing. It's like, if you're the magazine company, that's something you have that's of outsized value to him, that's of less value to you, that you can give away easily. And so that's where he's like, instead of compromising on the high value main ticket item, which is probably usually the price, what perks can you get? That, you know,
I think that's a fairly kind of non-controversial, well understood thing of it, really, isn't it?
Yeah, right. Actually, when I started working for this company, they gave everybody free lunch, like fully catered. You'd have to join a line. It was like a little lunch hall, but they had all these catering things they would lay out. You could just buy chicken, mm-hmm. pork, rice and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't particularly high quality. I mean, it wasn't low quality food. It was kind of food you'd eat at home, but it wasn't like super fancy. Probably cost them $6 a head to provide this. And then they took it away. And the reason they took it away is like, we were the only office of the 10 or so offices they have that got this perk. All the other offices didn't get it. They had a fucking offsite meeting where they flew everyone into our fancy office. We have a climbing wall in our office. It's all tech office. It's fancy. These people saw our office and they were like, you give them free food? That's not cool. We have to pay for our food. And so then they took away our free food out of fairness.
Problem solved.
The worst word in the world is fairness. But what this did to my company is no more software engineers came into the office, period. It went from being like a mostly full or like 50%, 60% full office to a 10% full office overnight. These software engineers are paid $180,000 a year. They can afford to spend $6 on lunch. But it was the psychological difference that like small $6 thing that the company was spending was bringing so many people into the office because it was just like, oh, it's one thing I don't have to think about. I can, you know, just food is taken care of. I don't have to go and order it or walk somewhere to buy it. And that little thing meant that so many people are in the office. And when people are in the office, it is better. It's a ball ache to go to the office for the, what do they call it? Esprit de corps, which is a term that I learned from Disco Elysium. It's the sense of like, we're all in this together and we're all in a team and we're, you know, and just chatting to people. You don't schedule a Zoom call to be like, how was your weekend? But you'll chat about disc golf at your desk for 20 minutes. So anyway, it's that.
That was a big tangent.
That was a big tangent, but what I'm talking about is the negotiation here.
You were writing your own self-help book in real time.
The giving someone the something that is of no big deal to you is a grocery company we work for. They can get food on the cheap and provide it to people on the cheap. It was providing an outsized impact to these people who are already paid incredibly well.
Yeah, this sounds like if you were Malcolm Gladwell, you would be trying to shoehorn that anecdote into your book on negotiation. That's your tipping point. Little things mean a lot. You won't believe what happened when we cancelled lunch for these nerds.
We took away nerd lunch.
it wasn't like a negotiation in a kind of understood situation. And it wasn't that decision was made with those factors in mind, is it? Right, let's carry on. Deadlines are a man-made construct. I think Chris says like not to impose deadlines, but also if you do have a deadline, have it to your advantage. Don't have one that makes your life worse.
Yeah, deadlines are arbitrary and nothing ever happens when they pass.
It's a case of timing. And I don't think Chris emphasizes that enough in the book, more so than what you kind of say. You're going to be better off just waiting for the right time to kind of go into it. And also having an understanding of like what your own time frame is in terms of like how long you're willing to wait.
That's very important.
There's one example where he's like working on this kidnapping case with one of the hostages' brothers, and they've kind of collectively agreed that they have to be willing for this guy to die in order to get the best price for him. And it's like, yeah, I guess if you're willing to take on that risk, then that's how you're going to get like a really sweet deal. But you also have to acknowledge that there's something of a problem with that kind of like line of logic.
Didn't they go get his like cousin or something that was much more cavalier about
maybe that was it.
They were like, that's where he went and was like, we got his relative who didn't care about him that much to come in and offer like, I'll give you $5,731. And the guy had asked for like $100,000.
The next thing we have to discuss is prospect theory. And this is from Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, mostly now referenced from Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And Chris Voss acknowledges that this kind of comes from there. I think it's some of the most sound advice in the book, just because it's Daniel Kahneman's advice. But it's about how people choose between options that involve risks. It's about how people are drawn to sure things rather than risks, even when the risk is a better choice. People will take greater risks to avoid losses versus achieving gains. This is called loss aversion. He's kind of saying that you should almost use this to your advantage. Like the most simple application would be to remind your adversary what happens if they lose your business and how bad that would feel for them. You know, convincing them that they have something to lose if your deal falls through.
Yeah, preying on the loss aversion. That's definitely true. There's also, they've done lots of experiments on that.
Daniel Kahneman did the experiments.
Have you read Thinking Fast and Slow?
Yeah.
I have not. I have it in my library.
Okay, well, anyway, there's an example Chris Voss gives by Ellen Langer. This is a study from the 1970s that involves people cutting in the queue for a photocopier. And the research suggested that if you asked to cut in with a because reason, then the rate of success increased from around 60%, which was when giving no reason at all, and you know, you're literally just saying, can I cut in the queue? This went up to 90% if you said something along the lines of, can I cut in the queue because I have 5 pages to photocopy? The study claimed that the reason didn't even have to be very good, you just had to give a reason. And I think there's some problems with this. I don't know if it's been fully debunked, but there was some further analysis that suggested that whilst it might work if the request is very small, as in if you only have a few pages to photocopy, then no one really cares. But if you're asking for something bigger, then adding a fairly banal reason is probably not going to make much difference. This was, to me, one of those things where, you know, you have the most well-known psychological experiments and they're well-known because they're so sensational, where it's like, oh my God, you won't believe this. You've just got to give a terrible reason and everyone's going to let you do what you want. And you're like, oh my God, it's unbelievable. And it is unbelievable because it's a massive oversimplification and it only worked in a very specific test environment and no one's been able to make it work again since.
I agree. I do wonder if like something happened to Chris Voss involving photocopying.
He does love a good photocopying story.
Well, he does talk about how much of an absolute pain in the ass photocopying is. So maybe that was a big part of your life at some point. I do the opposite of that. When I'm in a slightly different scenario, like if I'm telling someone I'm not going to do something, I don't give anybody excuses or reasons. I have people that I work with that like will belabor the, well, this happened to me and then this happened and so I'm not going to be able to go to this meeting or whatever. Or I'm taking the afternoon off because this happened. I've got to go to this and I've got to go to a doctor's appointment, blah, blah. Whereas I'll just be like, I won't be there. Period.
I think you're better off giving like one reason maximum. The second you start kind of reeling off like a whole load of things that aren't connected to each other, it just sounds kind of like you're making excuses.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
If you just say, I won't be there because I have a broken leg, that's more convincing than I won't be there because I have a broken leg and my car broke down.
I don't even give anything.
I mean, if you had a good reason, there'd be no reason not to include that. But if you don't have a good reason, 100%, like if it's not their business, if they don't need to have that reason, if you're like the boss and they're just like your lowly worker, then they just have to accept the fact that you're not going to be there. And like, too bad. Like, they shouldn't question the authority figure in that situation under any circumstances.
Don't you question me. I hold your career in my hand. I will destroy you. It's like people don't really necessarily care. Often I won't have a good reason.
The next piece of advice here, which is about expressions of anger. These can increase a negotiator's advantage. However, the anger has to be real.
Fake anger is really weird. It doesn't align. Have you ever done that?
Been angry.
Just been angry at somebody tactically?
No, and I actually think this is actually sound advice, that it has to be real. He kind of then notes that it could cause, it's almost like, but it can cause some problems down the line. But yeah, no, he's got like two stock phrases that go with this. We've got one which is, I don't see how that would ever work. And the other is, it seems like you really don't care what position you're leaving me in. I kind of think the first of those, to say that rather than just like, no, is actually a much better response.
Yeah, you're sort of playing on that person's self-image of being like, you don't care about people and you're a bad person.
So I had some negotiation stuff that I was doing earlier this week, and I made a point because I'd just finished reading this. I was like, I actually want to try some of this stuff out and like see how it works in practice. I was hoping to be able to maybe use one of those phrases, but pretty much all of the theory went straight out the window. There just wasn't any opportunities to like do any of this stuff. Like, it just wasn't appropriate based on the way that the conversation was going. It's this framework that I don't really know how applicable it actually is going to be in its kind of specifics. But also, I do think there's some very like general advice and like a general attitude that the book promotes that is actually like a sensible way to approach negotiating.
Yeah.
Even at the end, you're just like throwing ideas into the mix. And then you get the acknowledgements at the end of the book, or what you think is the end of the book. After the acknowledgements, he's like, here is a structure for how you should plan out a negotiation. That bit at the very end of the book is some of the, like the best advice in the whole thing. Just that concept, planning before going into a negotiation, it's like, I'd never even bothered to do that before. And you don't have to be like very specific. It's like, if you just go in with the mindset of, I'm going to try and get a good outcome. And I think this is where there's actually like a little bit of truth in the photocopying thing. Part of it might just be about asking for what you want. You might not even be doing that or not doing it clearly if you don't go into the situation expressly thinking, this is the outcome that I want. And with the negotiation stuff that I did, it was literally just this thing of, they're like, oh, hey, here's the deal. And I'm like, counteroffer, what if it was this? And they're like, yeah, okay, but we're going to have to do like a longer contract. Chris Voss would hopefully approve. All right, deal, done. And like, you know, oh shit, I didn't get a chance to use the downward inflecting DJ voice. I'm not sure if I elicited enough empathy from the interaction.
Also, it's like, here's a tool belt of things, and sometimes you won't need to use them all.
Chris has one more kind of, I think, key insight in the book for us to talk about, and this is what he refers to as a black swan. For me, this was one of the most confusing parts of the book. The reason for this is that the black swan is kind of like a concept, is taken from Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Chris possibly loves the black swan because he calls his company the Black Swan Group. But then he comes up with what's actually a slightly different definition of the black swan. And this is where it gets a little bit confusing. So according to Taleb, The Black Swan is this like unpredictable event. But outside of the realm of regular expectation, it's something that can't be foreseen. And because of this, it's not accounted for in any predictions that are based on previous experience. That's kind of like the point of the Black Swan, is that if you look at the data, if you look at the previous period, if you look at whatever, then it's not going to tell you what could happen now because there are these unknowns that just aren't accounted for. Chris Voss takes that and then he explains it with an example of a bank robbery where one of the hostages gets killed. This isn't a correct example of what a black swan is. Like, he's saying this never happened before.
Impossible to foresee.
I mean, it's not the outcome you want from the situation, but it is obviously a foreseeable outcome. It's the thing that you're trying to prevent in, like, every bank robbery hostage scenario.
Doesn't he talk about, like, the person killing someone on deadline?
This guy was suicidal and wanted to die, and therefore he behaved differently.
Yeah, it's a watering down of Taleb's initial, or at least the scale at which Taleb was pitching a black swan event. The notes that I have here talk about, like, there might be, if you're negotiating with someone, you might not know some piece of information that changes things, like the CEO you're negotiating with hates the current software they're using and really wants to change.
Yeah.
Whereas you think you're going in being like trying to convince them of reasons they should give up on their current thing. So that's like a real big shift. If you find that out, now you're going in totally differently.
Yeah. I've got one more piece of negotiation advice to add. This is something not in the book, but I found that it can work quite well to split out the positive and negative parts of negotiation into two separate roles. So maybe you have one person who works with the client on the project, and then someone else who comes in to negotiate the price, kind of like a good cop, bad cop situation.
I think that's the great idea, because it is a skill set that's very hard to build as a normal person. Like, if your job involves a lot of negotiation, I mean, you're obviously not going to be in that job a long time unless you get good at it, or at least have above average outcomes or non-terrible outcomes. But for a normal person, it's like salary negotiation for a new job. You might get a new job once every 5 or 10 years, which is not something you do all the time. Same with buying a car.
Yeah.
Why there's a negotiation on vehicles, I don't know. It's pretty crazy to me. I found the more expensive something is, the more wiggle room there is. I was selling my house and we had appliances in there that were brand new when we bought the house 5 years earlier. And so I spent $1,500 on all the stuff. And they were like, will you throw the appliances in? And I was like, you can have the appliances for $3,000. And they're like, deal. And so I charged them double the rate I paid new for 5-year-old appliances. And the reason I could do that is because they were spending $300,000 on a house. So it was a 1% cost increase for them. And they got stuff. They didn't have to move any of their shit. It's all plumbed in. It's all ready to go. I absolutely extorted them on what the actual value of the stuff was. But from their standpoint, it's a 1% lift. And so when something's really expensive, the wiggle room is greater.
But did you use the downward inflecting DJ voice?
I did not.